Red Sox fans have talked about 2004 and the postseason to death. But can you believe there is a game where the Red Sox won against the Yankees that is somehow underrated? You don't believe me? Well, you better ask author John Vampatella on this episode of Locked On MLB.
You are Locked On MLB, your daily MLB podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, baseball fans, and welcome to Locked On MLB, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, where it's your team every day. Thank you for making us your first listen, as we're available on all your free podcasting catchers. I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. If you look at the lower third, where is it? It's right there. You can call me Sully. On today's episode, I'm very, very happy to be bringing on board author John Vampatella, who is going to be talking about his book, The Forgotten Game, about that one game that seems to have fallen through the cracks in the memories and the legend of the 2004 American League Championship Series, which in many ways was the most dramatic game of them all. And we are going to be talking about this book and other memories, and we're going to see where it goes, because guess what? As someone who is a rabid Red Sox fan living in New York at that time, I have things to talk about. But you can follow us on Twitter, Lockdown MLB Pod, same handle for Instagram. You could follow us on all your podcasting platforms and on YouTube. And guess what? If you tell your smart device, if you happen to have one, to play podcast Locked On MLB, or you can check out some of the other great shows on the Locked On Podcast Network, including Locked On Bets with your boy Q and expert Lee Sterling with his picks. But hey, enough of my yapping. Those of you who know me, and I know I do, that I am a native New Englander, grew up a huge Red Sox fan. In order to get me talking about 2004, all you have to say is, "Hi, Sully." And next thing you know, I'm talking about 2004, as every Red Sox fan does. But there is that game that sort of has fallen through the cracks in the lore. And I am very, very happy that the author of The Forgotten Game has, he's now part of the show. Let's bring him on board. Hey, John Vampatella, you're on Locked On MLB. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Sully, I'm doing great. I am so excited to be chatting with you today.
Now, tell people a little bit of who you are. I mean, this is not a book where you just printed it out and you're stapling, you're handing it out on the street corner. This is a book which is about several things, but it's primarily about Game 5 of the 2004 American League Championship Series, not Game 5 of the 2005. That was between the White Sox and the Angels. I'm not writing a book about that. If I was a big White Sox fan, hand it to Jimmy Pardo, I think he'd probably like it. But you wrote about Game 5 of the 2004 ALCS. And tell us a little bit about you and your background. And I know you people on EEI are probably familiar with who you are.
Sure, thanks. Well, I grew up a Red Sox fan. I'm currently living in Connecticut. I grew up in Maine. And I serve in a sports ministry context at the University of Connecticut right now. So being an author is a relatively new thing for me within the last year or so. I grew up a Red Sox fan, but the interesting thing about my Red Sox fandom is that my dad is a Yankee fan, and he was born in New York on Long Island, and we lived there the first 4 years of my life, but then we moved to Maine. So I'm 4 years old. We moved to Maine, and I know nothing about baseball at the age of four, but by the time I was old enough to start thinking about baseball, here I am immersed in the baseball world of New England. So all the credit in the world goes to my father, who allowed me to grow into whatever fan I was going to grow into. You can imagine he would have wanted me to be a Yankee fan, right? His favorite player was Joe DiMaggio. And, the Red Sox were the arch enemy. So for him to allow me to grow up in whatever fan situation I was going to grow up in, I thought was pretty good parenting on his part. Well, naturally, I'm surrounded by Red Sox fans everywhere I go. My Little League friends were all Red Sox fans. And this is back in the 70s. And so I would fall asleep at night during the summer with my clock radio playing on the radio.
There was a little glitch there. Not sure what happened. You went away. You were listening to your clock radio. We're just going to keep keep moving. Sometimes we have technical hiccup, but there you go.
Yeah, no worries. The audience doesn't realize the technical hiccup that we had to start this entire show today. So listening to my clock radio, I'm falling asleep listening to Red Sox games. And then in the morning, I would wake up and I would go run out and grab the newspaper. And of course, everything in the sports page is about the Red Sox. So I would follow the players. I would know all the stats. And so it was very easy for me to grow up a Red Sox fan. My first baseball experience in a real ballpark was at Fenway when I was about 8 years old. And I got to see George Scott, if you remember him, hit a grand slam that day. So it was just easy to fall in love. And I don't know, Sully, if you remember your first experience at Fenway Park. For me, I remember it very clearly. I emerged from the tunnel, getting ready to go to our seats. And, you know, I see the green monster and I see the players tossing the ball in the field. And I see the green grass and the brown dirt and the crisp white lines and the energy in the ballpark. And it was just, it was a cathedral.
Yeah. Right?
Just an absolute cathedral. And, you know, I was completely hooked at that point. And I had no idea the torment that the Boston Red Sox were going to put me through over the next few decades. And thankfully, in 2004, all that kind of ended with that great 2004 season. And I wanted to write a book about that. But there's been a lot written about 2004, as you know. Historic team for Red Sox fans. But I wanted to do something a little bit different. And so I did a deep dive into what I think is the best game of that entire postseason run. And it's a game that most fans don't really think too much about.
Yeah.
Everyone remembers game four, mm-hmm. Dave Roberts with the steal and the comeback off Mariano Rivera. Everyone remembers game six because that was the Curt Schilling bloody sock game. And everyone remembers game seven because the Red Sox finally completed the comeback from 3-0 down. But if you ask people what happened in game five, they have to scratch their heads a little bit. And they're like, I don't know. I don't really remember a whole lot of game five. Even some diehard Red Sox fans that I know of don't remember a lot about game five. And I think it was the best game of the bunch. So I did a deep dive into this game and really retold the story of the game and the background of the players and managers involved. And it was a total blast to put this project together.
Okay, I'm going to back up a little bit because I happen to really, really agree with you about Game 5. But I want to back up because you and I have – there's a similar background that you and I have. My father grew up my mother and father are from Bridgeport, Connecticut. I used to think that all life emanated from Bridgeport, Connecticut. And
you're the first person I've ever heard to say that.
All my aunts, all my uncles, everyone came from Bridgeport, Connecticut. And my father grew up a big New York Giants fan, rooting for Willie Mays and everything like that. My mother grew up a big Yankee fan, and her favorite player was Mickey Mantle. And my grandfather on my mother's side was a huge fan, especially of Yogi Berra, the Italian side of my family, they loved Yogi and Phil Rizzuto and everything. So my mother grew up a big, big Yankee fan, and I was born near UConn. My mom went to UConn, and I was born in Willimantic. And Connecticut is like the battleground state of, like, it's between New York and New Haven. Connecticut is basically a giant suburb of New York. But once you get past New Haven, it's New England. So there's this, I've equated it to basically where the commuter line from New York goes through, that's all still New York territory. You will see some Red Sox fandom bleed into there, and you will see some New York fandom bleed a little bit north. It gets to be very purple. You know, if it's blue and red, it gets to be very purple. Then by the time you get to Hartford, it's pretty much Red Sox territory.
Sure.
But it is a place. It's kind of odd that's where ESPN settled. Was in the middle of the Red Sox-Yankees cauldron. To my mother's wonderful credit, my father and I were huge baseball fans, and he taught me a lot about baseball fandom. But my mother was a huge part of my baseball fandom as well. She had all these books about baseball history, which she had as a little girl that I consumed. And my mother never, I became a Red Sox fan because we moved to the suburbs of Boston. And I remember George Scott, I remember vividly. The first team I remember completely vividly was the 79 team. But I, thank goodness I wasn't, didn't really understand what was happening in 78. That would have been too much. Would have been too much.
Yeah, that was a tough, that was a tough year.
But sure. You and I had very similar situations where, you know, we had parents who were not Red Sox fans, but we were assimilated into Red Sox fandom because the lure of it, you know, it's just an absolute surefire bet that if you lived in New England at that time, you are going to become a Red Sox fan. And if you're going to be making any bets, go to Bet Online. It's the fastest and easiest way to bet on all your sports action. Now, head to the new updated desktop or mobile website to sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Just use our promo code LOCKEDON to receive your bonus. From basketball, football, NHL, boxing, UFC, right down to your favorite Vegas casino games, don't wait to take advantage of all the amazing offers available for the 2021 season. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet on all your favorite sports. BetOnline is where the game starts. All right, we are here with John Van Patella, author of The Forgotten Game. And let's talk a little bit about game five of the American League Championship Series in 2004. I will give this little preamble. I know it's been talked about to death, but it's important to give this little bit of backstory. The Yankees were thumping the Red Sox over the years with the curse of the Bambino, and just, you know, 12 months prior was Grady Little leaving in Pedro too long, Boone hitting the home run, blah, blah, blah. And this was supposed to be the team where they went all in. They pushed their chips all in, bringing in Schilling, bringing in Folk. Nomar can't play every day. We'll have to trade Nomar because we're going to try to win right now. And they sweep Anaheim with the Ortiz home run. And it's like, okay, here it is. Because these two teams were clashing. The Red Sox and Yankees were clashing all year long. And the first three games, it just was like a fart in the elevator. That the Red Sox lose game one, Schilling gets hurt. Red Sox lose game two, they edge out Pedro. That's the Who's Your Daddy game. And then they lose 19-8, which almost sounds like 19-18. And right. It was just humiliating. And it was just like they're going to get swept. And I remember saying after game three, trade everybody. Trade Manny, trade Schilling, trade Pedro. Let's just start again because this team is never going to do it. Fire Francona, everything. Game four, they rally against Rivera. Bill Miller's never remembered. He's the one who actually drove in Dave Roberts.
Yep, Ortiz right up the middle. Yep.
Ortiz hits the walk-off home run. Now, if anyone remembers my talking head moment, and I'll get, don't worry, I'm not going to cannibalize this interview, but I just wanted to say it's important that people remember the revisionist history about the 04 ALCS, which was Dave Roberts stole the base, and that was the turning point. At that moment, the Red Sox were on their way. Nope. Folks, that's not what happened. As I said in the HBO interview, part of me was really mad when they won that game because I had given up. I had just, they'd been swept. This year is over. I'd let go. It's time to move on with my life. And I said, how dare you put me through another game just to eventually lose? Just you saved face for my not getting swept. Congratulations. It felt like 1999 where it was like, exactly. Yeah, they lost in five games. Great. You won one game. Congrats. And game five is really the game that made everyone think, wait a minute, could they can't actually do this, right? So talk us through. It was Pedro started the game on the heels of Who's Your Daddy, and Mike Mussina, future two Hall of Famers, started this game.
Yep.
And away we go. So you're the expert of this game, John Van Patella. Give us a little bit of what made this game so special.
Well, you bring up just a great point that you know, it is revisionist history to think that, oh, once the Red Sox won game four, they were rolling. It's like, no way. And I'm with you. I thought, well, it's nice they won that game, but all they're going to do is just drag this out to stab me in the heart one more time, right? I mean, because winning four in a row, you know, after being down three, it had never happened before in the history of the sport. So it's not like, you know, we were asking for a whole lot, right? A team that never beats the Yankees in big moments to do something that's never been done in history, right? With a team coming off a 19-8 loss in game three. Sure, yeah, of course. Like, they've got this, no problem. It's like, no. I don't want to put it too strongly, but I can't think of any real Red Sox fan that has had any history with the team that thought they were going to come back and win that. But game five gave hope. And the reason why it gave me a little hope was because I thought, okay, the Yankees know that this has never been done before. They do not want this to go to a game seven. Because then all the pressure in the world is on them. So game six, if they can just get it back to New York and somehow scratch and claw a win in game six, anything's possible, right? And I think the Yankees could be in trouble. But, you know, I'm still waiting for the other shoe to drop. I'm still waiting for the bad moment. And as we know, in game six, two plays went in the Red Sox favor that normally would go against them. The home run by Bellhorn to left field that barely cleared the wall, and it hit a dude right on the chest. But they weren't going to call it a home run at first, and they had to, and this is before reviews came into play, but the umps got together and correctly ruled, and I thought, wow, I can't believe they got that right, because we all remember 1999 and the Chuck Knobloch fake tag of Jose Offerman.
There were two brutal calls that went. Yeah. There was a neighborhood play that didn't go the Red Sox way in extra innings in Yankee Stadium, and then the phantom tag. Up by Chuck Knobloch of Offerman. The Yankees are going to win that series anyway, but you don't need to give them a hand.
Right, exactly.
Anyway, back to...
Yeah, and then game six, the other one was just the A-Rod karate chop of Bronson Arroyo that at first they ruled him safe and were like, you're kidding, but then they got together, got it right. So anyway, to game five, great setup. Red Sox still need a win, but they've got Pedro going. Now, we know Pedro wasn't Pedro at that point in his career. I argue in the book, I'm giving something away here, but I argue in the book that at his peak, there's never been a pitcher better than Pedro Martinez. Some people won't like that opinion. I think I give some pretty good reasons for it. Mm-hmm. But 2004 Pedro wasn't that Pedro.
He was still a good pitcher, but he wasn't Pedro the Magnificent.
Exactly. Still a very good pitcher and a guy you're happy to hand the ball to, but not the guy who in 1999 struck out 17 Yankees and threw a one hitter, not the same guy. And he got off to a good start. You know, the Red Sox were leading 2-1 as they go into the sixth inning. And then Pedro's pitch count begins to climb. Right. And that doesn't bode well, because when he hits 100 pitches, and I explain this in the book, things started to go bad for him. And in fact, in 2003, Game seven, that's the Grady Little game, right? Pedro's on the hill. He gets through seven great innings, but he's nearing that 100 pitch mark. And we all thought he was done. Red Sox were up 4-2. They scored another one in the eighth to go up 5-2. My dad actually calls me in the bottom of the eighth inning. Hey, Dad, what's up? He said, hey, I just want to say congratulations. I'm like, congratulations for what? He said, well, the Red Sox are going to do it. I'm like, what are you talking about? There's still two innings to go. This is Red Sox Yankees. What are you doing? He's like, nah, Pedro's pitching too well. Well, we know what happened in that game. Pedro just gave up hit after hit after hit. And I'm losing my mind. And when Posada hits the double to tie the game, I literally hung up on my dad. I'm like, I can't even talk to you anymore. And so with that in mind, we're in game six now. Well, we're in game five of 2004. And we're in the sixth inning, and Pedro starts giving up hits and walks and hit batsmen, and the bases are loaded, and Terry Francona has the same exact choice to make that Grady Little had the year before. Do I pull Pedro or do I stick with him? And he stuck with him, and Derek Jeter, of all people, hits this bloop double, as he is so wont to do, down the right field line, scores three, and suddenly the Red Sox are down. They're down 4-2, and you're thinking, game over, right? Game over. They can't come back against the Yankees bullpen and Mariano twice in a row. Just not possible. And at that point, you know, the Red Sox are still fighting. They're pros, and they thought they could win. But I think most Red Sox fans at that point were like, I think we're done.
Well, I'm going to bring up, there's two specific moments that really could have turned everything around. And that was after he let up the Jeter double, A-Rod got hit by a pitch, Sheffield walked, and Matsui, who would have been the MVP of that series, he was having an unbelievable series, hit a line drive that Nixon kind of did a sliding catch on.
Yep.
That ball gets down. The base is clear, and it was what we thought was going to happen. And Francota's probably fired, and the curse lives on. And the other key moment, when after Ramirez into a key double play in the seventh, which I we're going to come back. Miguel Cairo got a double, and Jeter bunted him to third. And so there's a runner on third, one out. A-Rod struck out, and then, you know, there was a walk. And then Folk, who I think pitched 5,000 pitches the night before.
Yeah, his arm, he literally ruined his career for the Red Sox that season.
He came in to face Matsui again, who flew out to left. And that set up the bottom of the eighth inning of where the Sox were down 4-2. And Gordon on the mound.
Yep. And Gordon was shaky for them at this point. He was admittedly nervous going into that appearance. I talk about that a little bit in the book. And Ortiz is leading off, and he belts one over the monster. So just like that, it's 4-3. And now you're thinking, oh, now they're just one swing away. Right? You don't have to really mount a rally. All you need is one swing. And so you're back in the game.
And the same thing happened from the night before. Remember, it was 24 hours before, even less than that. Then Millar walks, and in comes Dave Roberts to pinch run for him.
Yep.
Well, Millar walks. Granted, it was not Mariano who walked. It was Tom Gordon. And Roberts comes in to run for him again in what is turned into his final appearance as a Red Sox player. He didn't steal the base, but it was a perfect hit-and-run play by Nixon, who singled
him all the way to third. Yep.
Got all the way to third. Now, at that point, you know, like, Torrey didn't want to bring in Rivera to pitch a two-out save, but essentially he brought him in with nobody out, and technically Rivera got a blown save, but that's a tough blown save. I mean,
very tough. Yeah.
I mean, there was runners on first and third, nobody out, and he got Varitek to pop up to center field, but it was deep enough to score. I mean, Roberts was so fast he could have scored on an infield pop-up. And that tied the game. And that it went to the ninth inning, where the ninth inning, what happened in the ninth inning, which again, they used it, my soundbite from Reverse the Curse of the Bambino on this, was one of the moments where I looked around and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Things are breaking differently for us this year.
100%. I know exactly where you're going with this.
So, you know, two outs, nobody on. Sierra gets a walk. Folk, worn out Folk. And what does Tony Clark do?
Now, Tony Clark, we have to remember, I never want to speak ill of the abilities of any major league player, because they're obviously the best in the world at what they do. But Tony Clark had played for the Red Sox a few years before, and he was terrible for them.
Terrible.
Absolutely terrible.
He was a good player with Detroit. He played for Detroit and then later played for Arizona and was a capable player both times.
Yeah, very, very, very good.
Not with the Red Sox.
Not with the Red Sox. And but he was having a pretty good season for the Yankees. And he's in there because John Olerud was hurt. And he hits a rope down the right field line. And if anyone who has never been to Fenway, I'll just need to describe the right field fence is only about 3 feet tall, right in the corner there, right by the foul pole. And Clark's ball hits the ground, kicks up off the top of the fence, and bounces into the stands. By rule, that's an automatic double, ground rule double. So Sierra had to hold at third. We actually saw something similar to that this year, Red Sox Rays in the playoffs, when a ball hit off the fence off Hunter Renfro, bounced into the stand, saved the Red Sox a run. And in this case, it saved the Red Sox a run. So Sierra had to hold at third, Clark had to hold at second. And when do you normally think that a ground rule double is actually a blessing for your team. But in this case, it was a fortuitous bounce for the Red Sox. If it stays in the park, 100% Sierra comes around to score.
Yeah.
But it bounced into the stands. He had to hold it third, and the Red Sox got out of the inning.
Yeah, and that's going to lead us. Now, the Red Sox did get a leadoff single from Johnny Damon, but he was caught stealing when we went into extras. And before we go into extras, I need a little bit of energy because even thinking about this game is wiping me out. And no better way for me to get energy than to grab a Built Bar. Now, Built Bars are the best tasting protein bars out there. And it's the holiday season, so grab a protein bar that tastes like a candy bar, or even better than a candy bar. It's filled with so much holiday goodness, decadent flavor covered in chocolate, but amazingly low in calories, sugar, net carbs, and fat. High in protein. You get the best of both worlds, delicious and healthy. Built Bars gives you that extra fuel that you need to bust down the mall doors and battle the holiday shoppers. And you get such great taste. Hey, do you want to dip your Built Bar in your cocoa? Get yourself that marshmallowy treat, then you need to get your hands on Built Bar Puffs. They're light, they're fluffy, they're marshmallowy through and through, different flavors like my personal favorite, which is raspberry, but there's mint brownie, cherry, double chocolate, cookies and cream, and peanut butter brownie. They taste so good, you won't believe that they're filled with protein. Go to built.com, use promo code LOCK15, get 15% off your order. Use promo code LOCK15 to get 15% off at Built Bar. At built.com, that's where you get your Built Bars. Hey, John Vampitella and I, we're taking this into extra innings. Now, here's the thing about the fact that these games happen less than 24 hours apart. The first game was game four was a marathon, 12-inning marathon that went so deep into the night. And then when this started hitting extra innings, there was like, oh, God, why didn't you just score that run the ninth? I don't have the energy for this. I don't have the energy for this particular game. And this is where, look at, the premise of your book is that this was the overlooked game of a postseason that had many memorable moments. And I think this is where I 100% agree with you. Because all throughout those extra innings where they had already burnt through Folk, they had already burnt through Timlin, they had already burnt through I don't think they had burnt through Alan Embry yet at that point, but they were running out of pitchers. And so the fact of the matter is they were going to face the Yankees without their best, but the Yankees had burnt through Gordon and Rivera. So there was always this sense of just keep them from scoring and then score a run off of some schmuck. And they just score off of the schmuck. And there was several times throughout the extra innings where the Yankees put runners on and couldn't bring them home. The Red Sox would get some runners on and then something awful would happen. And we'll get to what happened in the absolutely just sort of foaming your mouth nervousness of the 12th and 13th and 14th innings that I'm still not convinced are over.
Right.
And break down just the absolute listen to my voice, the anxiety building, knowing that all of everything else, bloody socks, Dave Robert Steele, everyone crying over their grandpa's graves, all that would have been nothing. No ring for Pedro. None of that. If one tiny thing went wrong in any of those extra innings, everything had to go right. And that's what made this such a mind-boggling game.
Yeah, it was on a razor's edge, right? And the Yankees still had some house money to play with, right? They could afford to lose that game because they still would have had a 3-2 lead. For the Red Sox, it was do or die. And so every pitch mattered, every at-bat mattered, every play in the field mattered. And as a fan watching the game, it was an exercise in torture. I mean, it was blissful torture because there's nothing better in sports than Yankees Red Sox playoff baseball, right? There's just nothing better than that. So it was great theater. But if you had a vested rooting interest in that game, it was torture. And the 13th inning in particular was the one that I call, it was my it was the most white knuckle ride of my baseball life, watching 13th inning. And here's the reason why, for folks who aren't familiar with it. Tim Wakefield is pitching in the game at this point.
And mind Wakefield, you, Tim Wakefield's the one who would have been the ALCS MVP in 2003, but also surrendered the home run to Aaron Boone. So all right. Anyone remembers of the Aaron Boone home run, not the fact that he pitched brilliantly his two other starts. Okay, I'm sorry.
That's exactly right.
Important. So his redemption is important to this story.
Sure, exactly. And the bummer about 2003 is that the last scene you see is Aaron Boone hitting one into the stands and Tim Wakefield walking off the mound with his head down. But he was incredible in that series. And even in the 2004 series, he was scheduled to start, and he gave up his start earlier in the game during that 19 early in the series in that 19-8 game. He volunteered to pitch some innings to save other bullpen arms because they would need them in the following game. So Wakefield is a hero in my book, certainly from a baseball perspective. And there's reasons why he's a beloved, all-time beloved Red Sox pitcher. But, you know, he's unique. And for folks who don't know Wakefield, he was a knuckleballer. And the knuckleball, when thrown correctly, is incredibly hard to throw. It's incredibly hard to hit, but it's incredibly hard to catch. And Wakefield's personal catcher, Doug Mirabelli, was not in this game. And Jason Varitek, a very capable all-star level catcher, but he wasn't a good knuckleball catcher. And so in the 13th inning, the Yankees, the game was tied, and the Red Sox, trying to hang on. Gary Sheffield leads off, and he strikes out, but he gets to first on a passed ball. And that's a theme that we would see running through the 13th inning over and over and over again. Matsui grounds out. Bernie Williams flies out. You're thinking, okay, we're in decent shape. But then with Jorge Posada up, remember, he was the guy who was up in Game 7 of 2003 who delivered the big blow off Pedro. There's a passed ball, right? And Matsui gets to second. They walk Posada, and now you get runners at first and second. Ruben Sierra's up, another pass ball. Now runners at second and third. And it's just like, oh my gosh, like Yankees are going to score the winning run without a hit. They're going to score the winning run on a pass ball, wild pitch where Varitek can't handle it. And there were several other pitches in that inning that he didn't handle well, but they just didn't roll far enough away for Yankees to advance. So there could have been five pass balls in that entire inning. But Wakefield eventually gets out of it, striking out Sierra. And it was like the Fenway crowd just kind of exhaled. And I remember I've watched this game about a dozen times in writing the book. And even hearing your voice, right, I still get nervous watching the 13th inning because I'm like, something's going to go wrong and history's going to change. And I still expect the wild pitch or the pass ball to come and the Yankees to score in that way. And I thought, you know, that would be just perfect. Absolutely just perfect. The Yankees are going to win on that of all things, right? But they didn't. And that's the moment I thought, wow, maybe they're going to hang on here.
And the fact that they still didn't score in the 13th, he had to come out again in the 14th. But the 13th inning was the most terrifying inning and you hit many of the different points on it. I also think it is, when you look at Joe Torre's career as a manager, there's a couple points in his career where he dropped the ball. And ironically, ironic term for this inning. But when, you know, obviously he's a Hall of Fame manager, I'm not taking anything away from him. But one of the biggest mistakes he ever made as a manager is he didn't have any of those runners going. He could have had, not that Sheffield or Matsui were, Tim Raines and Ricky Henderson, but the ball is going slowly, and it was clear that it was a 50-50 chance that Varitek was going to not even catch it. And to have the runner in motion and getting Varitek, force Varitek to catch the ball and throw it, they steal the base and the pass ball moves him. And the fact that he didn't send those runners, because you had one walk. How many do you had? You had the walk and the strikeout pass ball.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And officially one, two, three passed balls, and nobody scored.
It's amazing.
Not, and Wakefield, to his credit, kept having a call for, you know, I know I can't catch it. I know Mirabelli's job is to catch this, not me. I know the reason we have Mirabelli is because I can't catch this. But he had to keep putting down the signal for the damn knuckleball.
Right.
Because that's the only – and in the end, it worked. When he struck out Sierra on, mind you, a 3-2 pitch.
Right.
And strikeouts weren't even – that's not even a guarantee that you were going to get an out because Sheffield let off the inning with a strikeout.
Exactly.
It was that whole inning. I'm like, which this is it. Like, it's going to be a pass. And it's going to be poor Wakefield again. It's going to be poor Wakefield again. It's going to be the image of him throwing a pass ball and everything. And it's just, it's not fair. But the other thing to remember, I know you remember this, is the Yankees essentially had run out of pitchers. And they were stuck with Esteban Loaiza, who a few years before was a very good pitcher for the White Sox, but he had flamed out at this point. And he was basically there. You're going to go the rest of the way. So if the Yankees had clinched, it would have been Loaiza on the mound, jumping up and down and having a dog pile on him. And ultimately, it went to the bottom of the 14th.
Yeah. And Loaiza pitched really well, in his three innings of work. He pitched really well. He had given up just a walk in a couple of innings of work. And then in the 14th, he leads off by striking out Bellhorn, Damon, walks, and now you've got something cooking because Damon has good speed, right? So thinking maybe he can steal a base, even though he got caught earlier in the game on a great throw by Jorge Posada. But with two outs, Ramirez is up, and in a long at bat, Ramirez walks. So now you've got Damon at second, Ramirez at first, and up comes David Ortiz, the hero of I would say the night before, but it wasn't the night before. It was the morning, that morning, because he delivered the game-winning homer technically that morning. So he had a chance to be the first player in history with two walk-off hits in a playoff series on the same day. And he's up there, and it's a 10-pitch at-bat. And Loaiza, he was on that day. He pitched really well. And it was just a battle, him and Ortiz, fouling off pitch after pitch. And you're just like, oh, my God.
Ten pitches with two outs.
Yeah, your heart is just like you're dying, right, with each of these pitches. And then finally, Ortiz hits a fairly soft line drive that gets into center field. And Damon races around from second, and Bernie Williams has no shot of throwing him out. Damon slides in, and we're going to New York the next, you know, for the next game. And it was just an epic – absolutely an epic game by two teams playing essentially at the peak of their powers. Two great teams with four Hall of Fame players, four players who played in that game who are currently in the Hall of Fame, and there might be several more that make it over the next handful of years. So star-studded teams playing for the highest stakes that Yankees and Red Sox can play for, right? They can't meet in the World Series unless eventually those rules change. And so you're talking about the second year in a row these two teams are battling for this. And it was just an absolutely incredible game with so many twists and turns and moments that it could have gone the other way. Manager's decisions that you could have criticized and asked a million questions about. Game goes 5 hours and 49 minutes, so it's an eternity. And it had everything. It was a game that had absolutely everything. And yet the crazy thing, and the reason I call it the forgotten game, is – not because it's actually like people forget that there was a game five, but people just don't remember how incredible that experience was during that game.
It kind of gets washed over. Like you see, like when you see the package, it's like, okay, you have the Robert Steele, Miller singles him home, Ortiz homers. Then Ortiz got the game winning hit the next night, and then we have the A-Rod slap the ball buddy sock game. It's like, whoa. That was pretty interesting shakes right there. And here's just two other things I'll quickly say about that. I don't dislike Joe Buck. I think my main problem with Joe Buck is the fact that he always is the announcer. It's like Baskin Robbins now has one flavor. You know, I like it when they mix up your announcers. It's like you have a different narrator. But one of the best calls he ever made was Damon's running to the plate and he can keep running on to New York. Game six tomorrow night. And game six was, there was no travel day. It was the next day. So you had this, there was no chance to breathe. And right. I was at
these
games.
These teams had to strap it on right away. Day. No chance to recoup, nothing.
And I was at game six at Yankee Stadium.
And lucky
right
you.
Up at, and I remember in my head, I'm visualizing Tony Clark hitting a 3-run homer off of Keith Foke to end the game. because I thought yep. Foke is shot. He's shot. He's you're asking him to pitch 3 days in a row. You can't. And I'm like, oh, the poor Foke, he gave his guts out and he's going to be the GOAT. And it's Tony Clark of all people, Tony F and Clark.
Yep.
And it really wasn't until it's funny. Like someone was asking, like we were doing like a, you know, your first memory of when you say a year, like, you know, so it's a 2004 Red Sox, your first memory, first thing pops in your head. And for me, it's Johnny Damon's grand slam in game seven. Sure. And the reason it's that is because that's the first moment I allowed myself to think, we're going to win this.
Right. I can totally relate to that. People have asked me, when were you convinced the Red Sox were going to win? And for me, that moment came much later. It came when after Pedro came in to pitch, kind of an ill-advised moment for him to come in and pitch, and the Yankees scored 2 runs, and all of a sudden you think, oh my gosh, they're back in this game.
Yeah.
Then the next inning, right away, Bellhorn hits a home run. And it kind of just negated everything the Yankees had just done. And at that moment, I thought,
yeah,
I think we're going to do this.
By the way,
because I just kept waiting for the Yankees to come back, and Derek Lowe was incredible in that game, game seven. He shut them down. I became a true believer later in the game than you did.
Yeah. I mean, that inning was horrifying. And especially because Pedro was my favorite player and I could not deal with him being the GOAT. But I also got the sense that, you know, part of me felt like, you know, they'll pull him if he lets up another run. You know, they're not going to go through this. But the Bellhorn home run did just say like, no, there's no momentum here. This has been great. I can't believe how long we tell people where they could buy this book. I've read it already. It's great. But for everyone else, tell people where you can get the book. Maybe, you know what? Rush order it in time for Christmas and everything.
Sure. So here's what the book looks like, or what the cover looks like anyway. You can order it from Amazon. Great place to order it. If you order it, I would love for you to leave a review. I've had a ton of people read the book, but not that many people have put reviews down. The reviews have all been great, but it really is helpful if people put down a review. I would prefer it, believe it or not, if people order it from Amazon. There have reasons for that. But if you are interested in an autographed copy, I'm new enough to the author game that it still kind of cracks me up when people want an autographed signed copy, but I'm more than happy to do that. In order to have one of those, you'll have to order it from my website, which is johnvampatella.com, and just click on the shop button and you can find that and some other things that I've worked on. And I'd be more than happy to send you one. I'm just excited to be able to chat with you, Sully. And even 43 minutes goes by in the blink of an
eye when
two baseball fans are talking baseball and when two Red Sox fans are talking 04, right? It's like,
I couldn't believe I saw the runtime. I said, really? But I'm not going to cut much out of this episode. I think if you're a fan of this game, it's great. By the way, also, you know, thank you for making us your first listeners. We're available on all your free podcasting platforms. Check out Locked On Red Sox if you want to hear more about the Red Sox, and also check out Locked On Bets with your boy Q and expert analysis from Lee Sterling. Well, hey, look at John Vampatella. Thanks so much for being part of Locked On MLB on this episode, which is being dropped on the shortest day of the year. The 21st day of December 2021. Looking back, as all Red Sox fans do 24/7, thinking about 2004. This has been Locked On MLB. I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully.